My great-great-grandfather Hello. Was the first Labour Lord Mayor of Manchester, and he brought in minimum wage for labourers.
Really?
Yeah.
You're going to have to get up in the microphone and tell us that on. This is good B-roll right here.
Hi there, everybody, and welcome to episode number 3 of the Practice Networks podcast. We're doing things a little bit differently this episode. Jules and I recently went on the road with Kate, and at the Just Life Centre in Manchester, we interviewed Rebecca Fox, one of Just Life's specialist support workers and a trained psychotherapist. The conversation was really fascinating, and we learned a lot about, well, how frontline work is different in Sussex and in Manchester. As with every episode, we start with a bit of a check-in. Do enjoy.
So, it's probably worth starting with a bit of a heat check, Rebecca.
Okay.
Jules, do you just want to spell out and tell everyone what the heat check is?
Hi, I'm Jules. I use she, her pronouns. I am a networks project worker. I also work on the Common Ambition Project. As individuals, we find different things difficult and triggering. The type of day you're having can also have an impact on how you deal with difficult subjects. That's why checking at the beginning is so important, as it brings our awareness to how we're doing that day. So I don't mind going first. So I will start with a bit of how I'm doing and something that has inspired me recently. So I am quite excited today to be in Manchester, probably slightly manic, but very excited. And something that inspired me this week was the Common Ambition Lived Experience group had an event, and a lot of our members spoke and did little speeches at a celebration event, which was a little bit moving and almost tear-jerking, I'd say. So, yeah. Rebecca, over to you for a bit of a check-in and heat check, please.
So I'm Rebecca, I use a she pronouns, and I am a specialist support worker in Manchester. Today, yeah, I feel really excited today to be doing this and to see you both in the flesh, because we don't get to see each other that often.
No.
I have been feeling really tired recently with long COVID, which hasn't been pleasant, but today has been quite energising, which is really good, so I'm really happy to be around and be doing this.
Yeah.
Sam, over to you.
Welcome, Rebecca. I'm really inspired to be in Manchester. It's been a very long time since I've been here. And just the journey up, I think we've already got quite a lot done. You know, when you don't have access to decent internet, you end up having lots of interesting conversations about how you can actually improve what you do when you're not on the internet. But this is just a really galvanizing experience, and especially seeing what Just Life do in Manchester. I mean, the practice networks are so focused on East and West Sussex that to actually hear what you do will be fascinating for me as well as our audience. So thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
Yeah. So would you like to tell us a bit about your job? But I think that's always a good place to jump in and just tell us about what you do, why you're passionate about it, and we'll go from there.
Great. So I support people that are living in unsupported temporary accommodation.
Mm-hmm.
And we work in a person-centered way. So that means that the work is really led by the people that we're supporting, which is the thing that drew me to this job in the first place.
Yeah.
So that means that we trust that people know what is right for them. So we don't come in and say, you need to do this, you need to do that. We allow them to let us know what they might need a bit of help with. And then, you know, I think a lot of people struggle with understanding the system or understanding how to do things. They might not have access to the internet. They might not, you know, some people aren't able to read or write. So we can come in and help explain things to people. So some of the things that we might do might be supporting people with setting up bank accounts, making sure they're on the right benefits. For people that want to move away from living in temporary accommodation, we can support them with that. So often we're doing a lot of housing applications, and we might refer them to different services that can support them in different ways.
Mm-hmm.
But really it's about like really being alongside someone in their journey and just being with them as things happen, kind of helping people to realize what their skills and their strengths are and kind of building on them, and then supporting them to be able to live in their new accommodation, or if they've chosen to stay in there in the unsupported temporary accommodation, to make sure that that's safe and secure and that they've got all the connections that they need to be able to live their life in the way that they want to.
Yeah, fantastic. And we have health engagement workers down in the Brighton branch of Just Life. Perhaps Jules, having worked as a health engagement worker, are we able to sort of explore how the two roles are different at all?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know anything about the TA landscape at Manchester at all. I think it works quite differently. Am I right in thinking you have lots of B&Bs?
Yeah, so it's mostly like privately run B&B type places. So they're kind of, people will have a room and then maybe shared facilities. So they have a license agreement there.
Mm. And who owns the B&Bs?
So it's owned by private landlords.
Okay, and then they get housing benefit, I guess.
Yes, sometimes, yeah. So if, I think for people that are working, they don't get much, if any, sort of financial support with the housing costs. But most people will get housing benefit or universal credit housing costs.
And they're quite, there's lots of different owners, aren't they? In Brighton, we have a lot of TA is owned by a few people. Whereas I get the impression in Manchester, it's lots of different people.
Yeah, all quite separate.
And do you have relationships with the B&Bs?
Yeah, so and that's a really important part of our work, is building those relationships, because there's times where we can, by having that contact, someone that's a bit separate from being like living in there, means that, you know, we can come in sometimes to mediate between the residents and the landlords, or support the landlords if they're struggling with things. What would be ideal is if landlords refer into us when people move in, which does happen sometimes, but that's one of the reasons why we go out on outreach. So we have a great minibus that we get to drive around in, so that means that we can go out to the actual accommodations and meet people there. So sometimes we can just even just go in and saying hello and giving them a flyer or letting them know about us, that first point of contact, if we don't get that from the landlord, is really, really helpful.
So you've just finished some very exciting training. Do you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, so I recently qualified as a psychotherapist. So that's been many, many years of training. And something that I was doing whilst I started here at Just Life. So I've set up my own practice as a therapist. But I bring a lot of those skills into the work that I do here, which was really helpful actually when I was training to be able to kind of use some of those skills in the work at Just Life.
Yeah, so what might some of those skills be? What are the applicable things?
So I think the main one, I guess the kind of communication and listening that you do as a therapist. So if we think about a normal conversation you might have with someone, you might both share information or both be talking about yourselves. Whereas in therapeutic relationship, it's all about the client. So I won't be talking much about me. I'm interested in finding out about their life. And that's really helpful in this work, because we do want to find out about people and what they want and what's best for them. So being able to really listen and pick up what's going on for someone is really helpful. And I think even just being able to pick up on how they feel about things, I think I've noticed in the work that I do that actually sort of facilitating that emotional support, because it's not therapy that I do with people at Just Life, but having that openness to for them to share how they feel is really important. I have someone who says that they don't talk to anyone else about how they feel, so actually having that space to do that is really valuable for them to just be really open. And then another really important thing is empathy. Like I think that some people struggle with knowing what that means or how to offer it, and actually just really being able to sit with how someone's feeling and acknowledge what they're going through is really powerful. A lot of the people that we support have so many different things going on in their lives, not just the challenges associated with their living conditions, but things from the past, current issues, relationship issues, health issues, and really being able to acknowledge what someone's going through is really important, and that really helps build a really beautiful relationship.
Totally. Yeah, no, that's good to hear. And I mean I think empathy, as you say, it's one of those slightly ephemeral things that can you put a definition on it, but it really does just factor into every line of this sort of work.
Yeah, because a big part of the training is learning about yourself, so then I learn about how I relate with other people and my own kind of strengths and what I can bring. And I think for the people that I support, I think that, I mean, I've always been quite a non-judgmental person anyway, and that's another big part of therapy work. And people really sense that, and that means that they will open up about things that they're experiencing or doing. Like, they might feel more comfortable to share that, yet that they are using drugs, or that they are like struggling with a particular thing that maybe they might worry that someone would judge them for, but mm-hmm. they're able to sit and tell me about that, which then means that we can offer even more support around it by just having those really open conversations.
It sounds like quite heavy work. How do you manage your own self-care?
Very good question. I mean, that is so important, and I'm glad that you asked that, because I think a lot of people that do this kind of frontline work, we do it because we care and we're passionate about it and we want to make a difference to other people's lives. And it does have an impact. Like, you know, there's things that you hear or witness that are really, that can be traumatic. You know, a lot of people experience this. You know, I know people like in the emergency services, or anyone that's doing like frontline work with people that are, you know, experiencing challenges or experiencing trauma, that sometimes there's things that just really stick with you. And it's difficult to kind of process that and deal with it. I actually had some really amazing advice when I used to manage a temporary accommodation for women, and there was a helpline for staff to call that was like around mental health. And I called because I was really struggling with supporting someone with something. And this person said to me, "All you can do is your best." And that just meant so much to me. It was almost like I hadn't had that thought myself. I just needed to hear that actually what I was doing by being there for people was enough. Because I think it's so easy to go home and worry, or should I have done this, should I do this, and that kind of rescuing tendency. Whereas actually it's not our job to fix and solve everything. You know, we can be by someone's side and support them and signpost them and encourage them, but it's not all our responsibility. So what I find really helpful is trying to relinquish a little bit of that feeling of being responsible, knowing that I've done my best and that's all I can do, that I know that I genuinely care, I know that I've done what I can do for somebody, and then just kind of trying to leave it at that.
Yeah. Similarly, when I was doing frontline work in various different settings, very similar, I would go into every place and say, "There's only so much you can do." I think I wrote that on various boards in most services that I worked in, and just to ensure that there is that boundary and we are all just doing our best, really. So I think that is really important to highlight.
Yeah, and I think as well, like, having quite firm boundaries with things. Like, for me, I only turn my phone on when I come into work, and I turn it off when I'm finishing my shift. I don't look at my phone, I don't look at my emails when I'm not working. If I need to hand something over, then I will. But holding those boundaries means that when you finish work, you've finished work. Yeah. You know that you've done what you can do that day. And then also just like looking after yourself, self-care.
Absolutely.
I know that I think self-care is kind of bandied around a lot, but it is so important. And I think often people realise when it's too late, when they are really burnt out and they're really struggling. But there's like little things that you can do to look after yourself that can make a big difference, like going out and getting some fresh air, or spending time with friends, doing things that are energizing rather than draining, or, you know, saying to someone, "Actually, you know what, I've really had to listen to a lot of difficult things today. I'm not the best person to listen to you right now. Maybe there's someone else you can speak to about what you're going through," which can be difficult when it's, you know, in your personal life with friends or family. But then it's also, if you've already spent so much time doing that, then you need a bit of space.
Well, it's ultimately chill out. Yeah, of course. And it's ultimately quite empowering and will make us all better at our jobs. I think, you know, I come from a comms background, and so actually not being in the support sector, so many of those things are just so directly related to what your actual output and your performance. And I just think that it is much more of a cohesive package within the support sector. What you were doing directly is that you need to bring your all to it.
Changing tack a little bit, you said you worked in a women's TA space.
Yeah, do you think you'd be able to tell us the difference between a women's only space and a co-gender space, and why the former is so important?
So the one of the main reasons that was kind of spoken about when in those services was because a lot of the women that would come and use that accommodation had been subjected to domestic violence. So there was just this kind of general idea that being in a space where there were only women in that space, there were only women staff there as well, meant that those women might feel safer or more comfortable. I feel like there is a need for gender-specific services because people have different needs. And also, I think it can... One of the really beautiful things that happens in temporary accommodation where there's multiple people living in one place is that they support each other. So I found that a lot of women found sort of like common ground or like friendship to kind of support them through a really difficult time. But yeah, the primary reason was that most people there were had been subjected to some kind of domestic abuse or violence.
And so the space felt safer if it was women's only.
Yeah, which I'm not sure whether that's like the be all and end all, because there's always risk in different spaces.
Sure.
But I think because most of the perpetrators were men, it seemed like, okay, here's a way that we can make these women feel safer, where they can be in a space where there are just women in that space.
Thank you. Also, for people listening in Brighton specifically, when we're referring to TA, we're referring to emergency accommodation. The language is awkwardly a little bit different.
Yeah, so actually Sarah brought that up on our last podcast, but for me, as someone who has only been in the support sector for a short amount of time, difference between B&Bs and temporary accommodation, are they more or less the same thing?
Yeah, so I think temporary accommodation is the kind of wider definition. I think B&Bs are a type of temporary accommodation, do correct me if I'm wrong. Whereas in Brighton, temporary accommodation, also that goes by EA, it's still TA, but they're managed in a different way. They're kind of owned by organisations. The buildings are owned by organisations, whereas here they are owned by kind of smaller landlords in B&Bs.
So we distinguish temporary accommodation and unsupported temporary accommodation.
Yeah.
So when we say temporary accommodation, we mean accommodation that's provided by the council. So sometimes they are run by the council and they are sort of HMO, so house of multiple occupancy. So some of them have 10 bedrooms, some of them are up to like 30, 40 bedrooms. But then they also can place people in hotels and B&Bs that they don't have council staff there. And then we define UTA or unsupported temporary accommodation as the ones that are run by private landlords where people aren't placed there by the council.
Okay.
So I guess the big distinguish is, have they had a homeless assessment by the council, and how have they accessed that accommodation?
You've got an awful lot of experience with person-centred therapy then, and we've kind of been dancing around it, but how do you apply that to your work now? And how do you kind of, tell us about that.
So there are core conditions that underpin person-centered therapy theory. So three of those, which are the kind of most common ones that are talked about, is empathy, unconditional positive regard, and congruence. So I use all of those in the work that I do at Just Life. So we talked a little bit about empathy. So really sort of getting in touch with how someone else is feeling, sort of like not walking in their shoes but walking next to them. So really getting a sense of what's going on for them and acknowledging what they're experiencing. Unconditional positive regard is like an acceptance of somebody, so not judging them and accepting all parts of them. So we all have different parts to ourselves, and if we can unconditionally accept those parts of someone, it can just really strengthen the relationship and help them learn more about themselves. And then the last one is congruence. So easiest way to describe that is that it's basically being genuine and being like honest in a way. You know, sometimes being honest isn't always the most helpful thing, but if we can be our genuine selves, then we can build up a better helping relationship. And then you can also notice what's called incongruence. So an incongruence is when someone says one thing, but another thing is true. So an example might be, they tell you that they've lied about something, but then in the next sentence say, I'm not a liar, or I'm not a person who lies. And actually sometimes noticing that or pointing that out to someone can help them to see parts of themselves. So I find that useful. Say if someone you know, a lot of the times you ask someone how they are and they say they're fine.
Yeah.
But then you know all the different things that are going on for them and you can say, well, I heard you say that you're fine, but actually I know that you're really struggling with this thing at the moment. Yeah. What's that like? It's sort of, yeah, you're just really trying to learn more about people.
Well, we've got a colleague that describes themselves as much a detective as, you know, a health engagement worker. And I think that's kind of what you're getting at.
You're
trying to get beneath the surface and see where and how you can help.
Yeah, but to do that, you need to build up trust. So that's, I think that's where that being genuine really comes in handy, because I think people want to know that you're doing this work and you're there for them because you really care, not because we're just here because we're getting paid to do this job. And I think that really comes across from everyone in our team, that we all really care and we do go above and beyond to support people. And we are thinking about how people are doing, and we are thinking, oh, you know, maybe this would be a nice thing for this person to do. So it feels very like personable. And the person-centeredness, for me, one of the main things is just really trusting that someone is the expert in their own life. Like, I could think, oh, it'll be great for you to do this activity, but they might absolutely hate that. I don't know, because I'm not them. So we just really trust that they know what's right for them. And there might be times we have to kind of bypass that if there's any kind of risk or anything. But usually, you know, we just trust that they know what they want to do and go with that.
So, Rebecca, what's the most direct way that people can actually engage in access therapy?
So there's a few different routes that people can go down. Some people will go and speak to their GP and ask for a referral. So then you can access like an NHS therapy service. However, the waiting list for that is usually very, very long. Depends where you are. But some people can be waiting sort of 18 months, 2 years, by which point, you know, you've reached out because you need support in that moment, and when that amount of time goes on, obviously a lot changes and you still need the support during that time. People can also access their IAPT service, so that's IAPT, so that's where you can self-refer for different types of therapy. Again, the waiting list can still be quite long for that. Or the alternative is to access private therapy. So I guess the main barrier for that would be financial costs. In Manchester, the price is sort of between like £35 and maybe £60 a session, but that increases usually the further south you go. So I know in London,
the higher end of that scale, certainly.
Which is a lot of money, because usually you want to be seeing someone weekly or fortnightly. However, I guess the benefit of accessing private therapy would be you get seen a bit quicker, and maybe and you've got more choice of who your therapist is. So you might want someone who has a certain specialty or certain experience, whereas when you've been on an NHS waiting list, it's kind of whoever's available. And there's always the option to say, actually, this isn't working out, I'd like to see someone else, which I would really encourage people to do, because the relationship is one of the most important parts of the work.
And we've kind of talked about the balance of power there. Do you feel that that's something that clients often feel, you know, okay, I've actually got this, I've waited for so long, they're scared to rock the boat maybe if they don't?
I think so, and I think maybe it, you know, it can feel really awkward because they might not want to have that conversation with the therapist, you know. Then they have to sort of feel confident enough to maybe speak to someone at the service and say, look, this isn't really working out for me and this is why. And that can be a really difficult conversation to have. Some people might end up just not going back, and then they might make their minds up and say, okay, therapy doesn't work for me.
I mean, that can just be a very instant decision. I mean, my therapist, we were instantly best friends, like we hit it off, but I realized that that's not what everybody needs, that's not everyone's style, you know. I you bring some of your own personality to it. Obviously you bring all of your expertise to it, but you are you at the end of the day. So it's always going to be a person meeting a person, and if you can make their life better in any way, then I consider that to be a win. But
yeah, definitely. And I think that's the thing that I like about person-centered therapy is that it's non-directive. So in comparison to something like CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, which is more about sort of people get given homework and tasks to do, which can be really helpful for some people, but for me it's more about the relationship with that person and really having that dedicated time that's for them to just talk about themselves, because we just don't get the chance to do that and really be heard, and for me to really experience them and accept them. And then, you know, that just leads to, you know, the things that they want to happen because they've got that space to process things, or they might make a decision or have a realization whilst they're in that session.
Yeah, absolutely. What can people expect in a therapy session, do you think?
Oh, good question. I can tell you I'll tell you about my, like, how I would do it, or which I guess is a kind of general expectation. So you'd usually start out with some kind of contract or agreement, which is a really important part of the process, because that's kind of all around boundaries and explaining confidentiality and the limitations of that. And I think that's really helpful to kind of set expectations from the start of what the work's going to be like and what the therapist expects from you and what you can expect from the therapist. And that agreement just kind of, I guess, it confirms that therapeutic relationship. So usually spend a little bit of time talking about that. And then for a person-centered therapist, the rest of the session is up to you, how you want to use that time. So I've noticed that in the first, or maybe the first few sessions, people tend to just tell you everything. And sometimes people can feel a bit vulnerable doing that, but it's actually really helpful and really important, because, you know, that's things that need to be said and need to be heard. And it also means that the therapist can get a really good sense of you and what's going on for you, and maybe a bit of your history. In other, like, modalities of therapy, there might be kind of more of a structure or agenda, which also some people can find helpful. Some people might want to come with a list of things to talk about. But I personally find that just kind of going with the flow and seeing what comes out is really helpful, because sometimes you kind of access that almost like subconscious in that way.
What advice would you give to someone who is thinking about it in the kind of context of taboos around mental health and maybe fears that people might have around accessing therapy? What would you say to someone?
The first thing I'd say is, like, it's completely okay and normal to feel unsure and to feel anxious and to feel worried about it, because, you know, you are being very vulnerable. You're sharing with someone who at the start of that relationship is a complete stranger. And there is taboo around accessing mental health services in whatever form. I think some people don't maybe understand what therapy is or the benefits of it. And there can be a lot of shame around accessing therapy, that people maybe want to know why you need it. And I would say that you don't always need a reason. You don't have to come with a really big, difficult, challenging thing or life experience, because just having that space to talk, it can sound really basic. And I'm aware that I'm coming at this, like, as a therapist and someone who, like, I have my own therapist who is amazing.
I think that's a very valuable perspective to have, though. To be on both sides of it.
Yeah, because I think, like, say if I think about when I'm with my therapist, having space that's just for me to talk about my own stuff in a really honest way, where I'm not thinking about hurting someone else's feelings or I'm not worrying about the impact on them. Obviously, I care about her and I don't want to upset her, but also that is her job. Like, people sometimes say to me, oh, I don't want you to be upset by this thing, but that is what we're there for, to hold space for that. So for me, having that space is just invaluable, because I don't get that anywhere else. You know, it's like I've said about when you have a conversation with a friend or family member or colleague, it goes both ways, and sometimes things might not get picked up on. But when you've got that person who is so focused on what's going on for you,
I just
find it really healing. Like, I feel very I feel very held, and I feel very loved and very considered and respected in that space, and that is also what I offer to people.
Wow. I mean, that articulates exactly what I expect and hope for from therapy, I suppose.
I think I could listen to you forever.
I think it's worth engaging with compassion fatigue.
Yeah, I mean, this is something that a lot of people that do any kind of frontline work with other people can experience. So when a lot of your time revolves around supporting people and hearing them and empathizing with them, sometimes you can reach a point where it's like you've got no empathy left. You are all out of empathy.
Yeah.
But that then sort of leaks into the rest of your life. So it can then be really difficult to actually empathize with anybody, because if you've heard such difficult things that people are going through, sometimes other people's issues can seem really minute or like they don't matter. People just get really burnt out, basically. So then you end up just not being able to empathize with anybody, which then affects your work, because someone could come to you with something really difficult, and because you're so exhausted from hearing so many difficult things, you might not respond to it in a way that you usually would when you actually have that energy and a bit of that empathy left. So it's something that's like, it's really difficult because it's sort of balancing that, like, wanting to care for people and support them, but also needing to care for and support yourself.
Yeah.
Which is why it's really important that frontline workers have a good support system. And that's, like, obviously within work with your colleagues, leaning on them and having a manager that's checking in on you and making sure that your workload's right for you.
Mm.
You know, and it's okay to say, actually, I'm really struggling with this person. Can someone step in and help? Or maybe I can take a little bit of a break from it. And also, like, reaching out to your friends and family and letting them know what's going on for you. Yeah. Because it's so much to hold by yourself. It's just not possible to hold it by yourself. Mm. So by sharing that with other people and letting people know what's going on, you can kind of ease a bit of that load.
Thank you so much, Rebecca. I've really enjoyed chatting to you and listening to you. We're gonna close, as we do every week, as of yesterday, with a bit of a checkout. So what, how you're feeling now, a little bit of a take and a little bit of a takeaway. I'm feeling inspired and a little bit tired. How are you feeling, Rebecca?
Yeah, I actually feel really energized talking about this. It's kind of reminding me why I love what I do, and feel quite proud actually of the way that not just how I work, but how Just Life works and supports people.
Thank you. Sam?
I mean, both professionally and personally legitimized talking to you, and it's nice to make a new friend as well, honestly. So warm as always, very grateful for our audience, very grateful for our guest Rebecca, my co-host Jules. Woo! And the ending of this podcast. Have a fantastic day, everybody.
Thanks for listening. This podcast has been a product of the Practice Networks, funded by Changing Futures and facilitated by Just Life, and recorded at the Just Life Centre in Manchester. All of the music and effects are from Upbeat, and the song you're listening to right now is Happy Feet by Samron. Have a great day.